greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today the topic is debt ceiling dance. Yeah, going on, right? I think it was yesterday that there was a report that, McCarthy and Biden are getting close. They both put out happy talk suggestion PR releases saying, we're agreeing on something. But then today, they broke off negotiations, and now they're back to where they were. What that means is they agreed on a bunch of stuff, and the remaining stuff, they're going to take a breather and go back to their main deciders, McCarthy and Biden, before they come back to the table again. Look, this is just a political theater, folks. This is the 79th time that the government has addressed the need to extend the debt ceiling. 79 times. They've done it 78 times. Do you think they're not going to do it again? But all the hoopla you get in the media is, the sky is falling. The sky is falling, right? But this isn't about the debt ceiling. That's going to get extended. What this is about is the behind-the-scenes negotiations going on by the two wings of the single corporate party of America, a.k.a. Republicans, Democrats, on what social programs to cut in the next budget coming up in October this year, the 2024 budget. That's what this is. Yeah, what to cut. And the focus, of course, is all on social programs. It's not about cutting defense. No. The Pentagon, they're escalating that one. They've already agreed $858 billion for the next budget for the Pentagon. And don't make the mistake of thinking that Pentagon spending is war spending, period. It's a subset of the total U.S. war spending. The U.S. spends about $1.1 to $1.2 trillion every year on defense and war. And it's going up, of course, because now, what did we spend? $300 billion on that black hole in Ukraine? By the way, keep in mind that most of that money is not going to Ukraine. It's going from the U.S. Treasury into the coffers of the military-industrial complex companies in the United States. The Raytheons, the Lockheeds, and all those other guys who will then send those goods, why do we call them goods, to Ukraine. Ukraine gets the hardware. They don't get the money, although there is some slush fund money going to Ukraine as well. The IMF has agreed for, $13 billion to keep its currency afloat. Yeah, sure. You think that's not going to get skimmed off? Yeah, they just indicted the Chief Justice of their Supreme Court for bribery. I don't know how many millions. Do you think the other Chief Justices aren't honey dipping? Yeah, of course they are. They're all honey dipping over there. The taxpayer in the U.S. is paying for it. So, of the $300 billion spent allocated so far to Ukraine, maybe 50 of that actually gets there, and most of it goes into the military-industrial complex. You got to keep those guys well-heeled here now that we stopped Afghanistan, right? They're just switching the title of their invoices. That's all. Okay, so, $1.2 trillion defense spending, quote, war spending. The other stuff is like in the Energy Department. The money allocated there pays for all the fuel for the U.S. military. And the U.S. military is the single biggest entity in use of fossil fuels in the world. Yeah, that's not in the Pentagon budget. And neither is the development of nuclear weapons. That's the Atomic Energy Commission's budget. And what about the CIA's private armies? No, that's in the CIA budget. Right. Who knows? The State Department playing that game? I think they are, too. Mercenaries, whatever. Behind the scenes, fueling, local insurrections and so forth. And then there's the veterans department. You know, you got to keep giving those guys raises. Most of it goes to the officers, by the way, not to the rank and file. Yeah. So all that together is $1.1 to $1.2 trillion. Some estimates are as high as 1.4. I'm just taking the middle estimate here. You got to understand. Well, you know, McCarthy and Biden aren't talking about putting a lid on that stuff. Not when it looks like the Ukraine war is going to get even more lethal. Yeah. The U.S. is, of course, backfilling its Eastern European NATO allies who were giving their junk Soviet stuff to Ukraine, and now they run out of that. So, you know, Poland, Lithuania, they'd love to give all that junk away, because now they turn to the United States and say, well, give us some of your new stuff, Uncle Sam. And Uncle Sam gives it to them and gives them special credits, low-cost credits, so they can buy it cheap, you see. And that way the U.S. keeps control over NATO with its majority now of all these smaller countries in NATO. And Germany and France are just tootling along. They don't run NATO anymore. Yeah. Well, the point is, you know, all this defense war stuff is going to continue. That's not what McCarthy and Biden are talking about. No, no, no. You know, they're talking about, well, how much can we cut Social Security? You know, how much can we cut education and transport, all this other non-defense discretionary spending? That's what they're maneuvering and debating about. And then they got this big gorilla on the budget block here called interest on the debt that they somehow got to find money for now, because running up all this national debt, and I'll give you those figures shortly, has increased the annual interest payments on the debt, in other words, the bondholders, bankers, and investors, that the government has to make. It's now paying this year $600 billion. A decade ago, it was paying $200 billion. Now it's paying $600 billion a year, every year. It's got to come up with that to pay the interest on the debt. You see, and that's what all this talk about, if the government doesn't pay the interest on the debt to the shareholders, then the shareholders aren't going to buy it. That's going to cause economic crisis and so forth. You know, that's what it's all about. They're afraid to aggravate the investors who want the $600 billion. So instead of finding money for $200 billion, now they got to find it for $600 billion. And I've seen estimates that by the end of the decade, it'll be $900 billion a year. So the interest, rising interest on debt is a problem, because they got to cut their spending somewhere else. And we know they're not going to cut war spending, right? And we know they're not going to raise taxes to cover the debt, be it interest or anything else. No, 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 no. Very clear. The two wings of the corporate party, America, a.k.a. Republicans, Democrats, right? The single party, right? Are in total agreement on don't touch the Trump tax cuts. And those Trump tax cuts passed in December of 2021, written in the back room by two guys, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, big finance capitalist, and Gary Cohn, I think he was the president of Goldman Sachs, I'm not sure. He went into the government just for that purpose, you know. And him and Mnuchin wrote this bill quietly, no input, two guys in the administration. And in December of 21, they dumped it on Congress, huge bill, hundreds and hundreds of pages, maybe 1,000 pages. It gave him less than a week to read it. No amendments, no debate. Pushed it through because Republicans controlled both houses at the time of Congress. Pushed it through within a week, $4.5 trillion. Yeah. Over the decade, of course, the coming decade from 2018 to 2028, $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. Oh, but the spin they gave was, it's only $1.5 trillion. That was the media spin, you see, because the actual $4.5 trillion would be offset by super growth of the U.S. economy, which means tax cut revenues would increase significantly over the next 10 years. And we would have a GDP growth from 2018 to 28 of 3.5% every year. That's how they got from $4.5 trillion to $1.5 trillion, you see. Also, they ignored some of the multinational corporations' deals on their offshore taxes called territory tax that they didn't include in their calculations of the tax cuts because it wasn't in the U.S., you see. Yeah, so the $1.5 trillion that they keep peddling around and the media kept peddling around and still does, and economists, mainstream economists, keep peddling around, including Robert Reich. You know, I keep tweeting Robert. I said, come on, stop using the $1.5 trillion estimate. It's $4.5 trillion. Because the assumption there of a 3.5% GDP growth did not happen. We know what happened in 2019, 2020, 21, 22, right? We know what happened. The GDP collapsed. And it still hasn't recovered. In 2022, the full year of reopening the economy after COVID, we grew 1% GDP. And before that, of course, GDP was contracting during COVID, 2020, 2021. And then we got a 1% growth. And what's it going to be this year? Measured December to December. You know, December 31st of 2021 to December 31st of last year, GDP net growth for the full year, 1%. Well, that's a long way from 3.5%, which follows the COVID contraction. And it looks like slow growth from now on out. So this 3.5% was totally phony. They didn't get a chance to debate that. No, they pushed it right through. They stuffed it down the throats of anybody who in Congress who wanted to look at that and add amendments. Well, no. 1 week is gone, passed. All right, so they're not going to raise the tax cuts. That's really clear of this first couple years under Biden. You know, Joe Manchin, the shadow president of the United States, made sure that none of the proposals amounted to raising taxes by rolling back the Trump tax cuts. He made damn sure. You know, his sidekick there, Sinema, senator from Miss Opportunist, senator from Arizona, right, ran as a progressive, turned into a Republican real quick. Yeah, her and Joe Manchin and the corporate moneybags running Democratic Party gave him full support. They don't want to reverse those Trump tax cuts. No. I mean, they could stop it. They could deal with their deficit right now and their debt right now. As I've said on the show before, you know how much tax cuts have since 2001 passed by Congress, tax cuts, $15 trillion. Yeah. Under George Bush Jr., $3.8 trillion. Under Obama, his rescue plan, $300 billion in 2009. Another $800 billion, extending the Bush tax cuts two more years. They're supposed to run out, you say, in 2010, but he extended it. Two more years, $800 billion. Okay, so that's on top of the $300 billion in the rescue plan of 2009, and then Obama agrees to extend the Bush tax cuts for another 10 years at a cost of $5 trillion. That was called the fiscal cliff, you see. And just months before that, he agrees with the Republicans to cut social programs, spending, education, transportation, whatever, by $1.5 trillion. So in August 2011, he pays for his 2009 $831 billion rescue plan by taking out $1.5 trillion out of suspending. So he gives it one hand, takes back twice with the other hand, and then he passes, extends the Bush tax cuts for another decade at a cost of $5 trillion. So he, Obama, cuts taxes by $6 trillion during his reign. That's more than George Bush, which is, you know, just short of $4 trillion. And then we get Trump, $4.5 trillion. There's your $15 trillion. Yeah. And how much did we throw away in wars, spending in the Middle East wars? Well, I think it's Brown University, as a study compiled, says $7 trillion for that. Well, wait a minute, $15 trillion in tax cuts, $7 trillion in wars, that's $22 trillion. And then we spend COVID about $4 trillion. That's $26 trillion right there. We got a $31 trillion debt right now that they're arguing about to raise the ceiling to pay the interest. Right, 26, 31, the difference is $5 trillion. That's exactly roughly what, well, I can't say exactly and roughly, can I? Okay, that was roughly what the total debt was in 2000. Yeah, somewhere around $4 trillion. So $7 trillion, right? And $22 trillion and $4 trillion for the bailout. $26 trillion. Well, that's what it is. That, those are the three elements, you know. That's what it is. If you didn't spend $7 trillion in wars, you did get $15 trillion tax cuts, 80% plus of which goes to the wealthiest 1% in their corporations, by the way, right? And if you didn't have COVID relief, $4 trillion, you know, the whole COVID relief is half of what they spent, roughly, on the wars in the Middle East, right? And not even one-third of what they spent in tax cuts. Look, what is the national debt? Well, it's $31.4 trillion. This is what they're all arguing about. You know, how do we keep paying that? You know, by the way, I don't know of any other country that does that, has a raises the debt ceiling, right? This is a gimmick to have an excuse, particularly when you have the two wings of the corporate party of America in a food fight. One runs one house, the Congress, and one runs the other in the presidency. You know, then they like this food fight, and they it's all about, you know, what they're going to take off the dinner table in terms of social spending. It's a cover. That's all it is. And 79th time they'll extend it. Yeah. What is the national debt? Well, very simply, think of the national debt as a hole in the ground. That is the accumulated result of annual budget, U.S. government budget deficits, right? If I got a hole in the ground and I got my shovel and I dig a scoop of it, right, of the dirt, that's the annual budget deficit. I throw it out, the hole gets deeper, the national debt hole gets deeper, right? That's what it is. That's the national debt and how it's created by annual deficits. Annual deficits are due to inadequate tax receipts, revenues, and or spending and interest on the debt. Three things. People aren't aware, but most of our annual budget deficit is due to the lack of tax revenue. 60%, studies show, of the deficit every year, and therefore the debt, is because we don't have adequate tax revenue. And as I said, we've got a loss of at least $15, $16 trillion due to inadequate tax receipts. And you get inadequate tax revenues because you're cutting taxes, and you get it because you got a slow economic growth. You see, the more robust GDP and economic growth is, the more tax revenues come into the government, corporate tax and individual income tax and so forth, right? Tariffs, et cetera. So it's mostly the lack of tax revenue. We've cut taxes and we've had slow growth. You know, after Obama, after the crash of 2008-09, the economy, quote, recovered. But it recovered about two-thirds of its normal recovery from recession. It was a very slow, sluggish recovery. We didn't really get back to the level of jobs we had in 2007 until 2015. It was a slow, poor recovery. There are reasons for that I'm not going to get into. So we lost tax revenues during that recovery. And then we get Trump with $4 trillion tax cuts, and did we get a huge recovery from that? No, we didn't either. The economy didn't grow much more than it did under Obama, slightly more. Yeah, so tax cuts aren't stimulating the economy the way they did decades ago, right? And the economy, every time we have one of these deep contractions, recessions, like the crash of 2008-09, the economy does not robustly, quickly recover. And we're having the same trouble here with the COVID crash, right? Post-COVID, the economy is not recovering very quickly, despite the most massive stimulus injected into the economy in the history, not only this country, any country. As I've said before on this show, and this is important, you should keep this in mind. How much did we stimulate the economy in 2021 to try to get it to recover from COVID? Well, in monetary terms, monetary policy, the Federal Reserve injected $5 trillion into the economy, $5 trillion. And the banks weren't even in trouble, and they gave them $5 trillion. And the banks, of course, give free money, virtually low interest rates to their shareholders and their investors and so forth, right? $5 trillion to the banks, keep them afloat. And Congress passed $4.4 trillion in various spending bills and more spending increases. So we got $9 trillion plus stimulus injection in 2021, $9 trillion. And for that, we got the molehill recovery of 1% GDP in 2022. $9 trillion, 1%. Don't tell me something is not broken. Seriously. You get all this happy talk of, oh, how great the economy is, where they grew 1% last year. For $9 trillion. You know, 2022 was the first full year of the COVID recovery. $9 trillion, 1% growth. Something's broken. It's not just the U.S. geopolitical global empire that's in decline and trouble. It's the U.S. economic hometown that's in trouble. Yeah. I mean, do you hear that argument anywhere in the media? I mean, it's the numbers, the government numbers. It's not my numbers. No, you don't. U.S. debt levels, 1980, the debt was less than $1 trillion, the national debt. By the end of the decade of the 80s, under the initial neoliberal fiscal monetary policies of Ronald Reagan, the debt had risen to about $3 trillion by 89, $3 trillion. So less than $1 trillion, we get to $3 trillion. Mm-hmm. By 2000, it was $4 trillion. George Bush, two terms, doubled it to $8 trillion. So, okay, it took 20 years to... Well, no, 10 years, really, to double. That's not quite right. I'm looking at 180 at 1980, and it's less than $1 trillion. 20 years later, it's $4 trillion. Okay. It doubles to $8 trillion by 2008 when George Bush leaves the office. When Obama leaves office, it's about $17 trillion. And when Trump leaves the office, it's like $22 trillion. And today, it's $31 trillion. And again, it's a combination of wars, war spending, and tax cutting. You know, this is the first time in U.S. history that we've had wars and Congress hasn't raised taxes. World War I, World War II, it always raised taxes. These wars in the 21st century, the wars of maintaining empire, I call them, wars of empire, since 9/11, Afghanistan, right? 20 years of, well, plus 20 years of wars of empire. We've cut the taxes $15 trillion. We increased war spending by at least $7 trillion, actually more than that, because that's just up to 2020, and it's not counting Ukraine. Okay, so we've got increasing by trillions and trillions of dollars our war spending. We're cutting our revenue base in the same time. Well, no wonder we got this huge debt. I mean, it's not that complicated to figure it out. Of course, they really complicate it for you if you listen to the mainstream media. Yeah, oh, it's Social Security. You know, all these entitlements. The Republicans like that, entitlements, you know. People got too much money. We're giving them too much money. You're not giving them anything because Social Security is the payroll tax. By the way, payroll tax, Social Security, is totally outside the U.S. budget calculations and all these numbers I'm talking about. It's not part of the U.S. budget deficit and the debt. It's got its own funding, the payroll tax, at least for the retirement section of Social Security, payroll tax. Now, what is that, 12.4% now? Half paid by the employer, half paid by the employee. Well, it's their money, right? They put it in. Medicare, 1.45%, right? 2.9%, but, you know. The employer and the employees put that in. That's not part of all the other tax revenues, the individual income tax and so forth that the government pays for. You know, it's war spending and social spending. That's not part of it. But yet they blame, oh, we got all these entitlements. We come up with these ridiculous numbers extrapolated for 75 years. Look, in 1986, they, quote, reform Social Security. Yeah, they instituted an inflation-adjusted tax formula for the payroll tax so that the amount every year, that 12.4% is taxed on, goes up. I think it's 160-some thousand or something. After that, you don't pay anything. Not too many people are at that level where before the end of the year, they stop paying the payroll tax because it goes up, right? And by 2000, the Social Security Trust Fund had generated $4 trillion surplus. And Bill Clinton used that surplus to say, oh, I balanced the budget. No, he still had a deficit in the regular true budget, and he just claimed that the $4 trillion surplus in Social Security meant he balanced the budget. But that surplus has gone down for various reasons over the last 20 years, including the fact that Barack Obama had a payroll tax holiday during the 2008-09 crisis, And Trump had his payroll tax holiday, too. Nobody's business, and workers were allowed to stop paying the payroll tax. Well, that took a bite out of the deficit, out of the trust fund, Social Security. And the government borrows from that trust fund every year, takes the real money from the payroll tax in the trust fund and uses it and puts a treasury bond that can't be bought or sold in its place, right? An IOU, right? That if you need to, you could spend it, see? It says, we're not borrowing it. Yeah, you are. Okay, so the one exception to this, the Social Security impacting the regular budget, of course, is the prescription drugs. Or is it the dental? I think it's the dental. No, it's the prescription drugs. Excuse me. Prescription drugs plan. I don't know how much that costs a year. Somewhere between $50 and $100 billion now. That comes out of the regular budget. They didn't pay. That was passed in 2005, but they didn't provide any payroll tax to fund it. They just paid it out of the general budget. So as that goes up, that's part of the general budget deficit as well. Yeah. Okay. When we get to the COVID crash, we get three fiscal bills passed during the COVID era here. One, the first bill was called the, in March of 2020, called the CARES Act. There were a couple of smaller bills that were passed in February, in early March, I think, of 2020 when COVID first hit. That provided money for the hospitals and so forth, emergency kind of thing. But the big bailout when the economy shut down in March, April, some extent May of 2020 was called the CARES Act. That was $1.9 trillion of relief. As I've written and talked about at that time, that was not a stimulus bill. That was a mitigation bill. In other words, to put a floor under the collapse that was going on in the economy and households at the time, right? A mitigation bill. And they were supposed to then pass quickly what was called the Hope Act, I think it was, in June. CARES Act was in March of 2020. The Hope Act was supposed to be the real stimulus bill. You know, you put a floor under the collapse and then you pass another bill to really stimulate the recovery. The Hope Act never got off the ground. The Republicans particularly opposed it. The U.S. House, which is in Democrat control at the time, did pass it, but it was dead on arrival. And the economy tried to open up that summer of 2020, failed to do so, relapsed, fell back. And you had Trump and his guy Meadows there trying to outflank any real stimulus bill and passing his phony bill, three phony measures that didn't amount to much. And the economy continued to sink at the end of the year 2020, and they quickly had to pass another emergency bill called the Response and Relief Act, or sometimes called the Cash Act, where they threw $800 billion in continuing unemployment benefits, mostly, into the economy again, because the CARES Act unemployment benefits were expiring, so they quickly had to pass another $915 billion Emergency Cash Act, a.k.a. Response and Relief Act, on top of the $1.9 trillion CARES Act, which had dissipated by then. And then we get our friend Joe Biden coming into the office, passing American Rescue Plan in March of 2021. That was mostly, you know, that's when we had those $1,400 stimulus checks, remember that? And unemployment extension for the first time, self-employed workers got unemployment, you know, gig workers and freelancers and so forth, who aren't regularly eligible for unemployment benefits. About 10 million of them, independent contractors, for the first time, they got unemployment benefits, and there was supplemental unemployment benefits. So unemployment benefits to help people in March of 2021 as part of the American Rescue Plan. That was the third major fiscal spending social program. A lot of the money, apart from the stimulus checks and the extended unemployment benefits, went to the healthcare system to provide testing and, you know, COVID relief and so forth. A lot of it was spent there. A lot of it was also spent on small business loans, which turned into grants. $935 billion was paid to small businesses. Now, healthcare got $420 billion. Unemployment benefits, $590 billion. So, you know, small businesses got 50% almost more than unemployed workers. And state and local governments got a big cut, too. Politically well-positioned, they got about $350 billion, right? State and local government. So, you know, on top of the CARES Act and the Cash Act, which amounted to about $2.8 trillion, we've got the American Rescue Plan, which is about $1.5 trillion. Now, the point is a lot of that $1.5 trillion American Rescue Plan got cut short. Yeah, they stopped. They cut it. The unemployment benefits got cut. The rent assistance got cut. Other Medicaid expansion got cut. Child care got cut. So a lot of that $1.5 trillion ended up not being spent. And then in 2022, Biden takes that, I don't know, $50 to $100 billion that wasn't spent. And all the talk about another real stimulus bill, not a mitigation bill, you know, like the 2020 CARES Act mitigation bill, the American Rescue Plan was a mitigation bill. They're all mitigation bills. None of them are real stimulus bills. So, you know, the whole idea was to come up with a real stimulus bill in 2022 that was called the Build Back Better bill. Build Back Better. Remember that one? Yeah. Several trillion dollars, $2-3 trillion. That was supposed to really stimulate the economy, you know, provide real continuous child care credits, free tuition for first 2 years of college. There were a lot of good things in that bill. But that's the bill that got shit canned, right, by the Biden administration, and Pelosi and Joe got, and Manchin got together and gave it the deep six at the end of 2021. Build Back Better was really thrown under the bus. And we had then three new bills that were substitutes for the Build Back Better bill. And those three new bills were subsidies to investment, subsidies to corporations, investment. So in 2021, to sum up partially, we get the CARES Act, we get the Emergency Cash Act, and we get the American Rescue Plan in the course of a year. And that's about, you know, $4 trillion in spending. Not all of it got spent. And then at the end of 21, that ends. And what was left of those bills was redirected into three new bills in 2022, which weren't really social spending bills, but were really subsidies to businesses and investors. What were those? Well, that was the infrastructure bill, right? The first one. That's about $1 trillion, infrastructure bill. And then we had what was called the Chip and Science Act. I think that's what it was called. Chips means semiconductors, not tortilla. I couldn't resist that, sorry. Think of that as the semiconductor slush fund. It is a bribery fund, $280 billion, to get the semi and chip companies to relocate from Asia back to North America. That's what that fund is all about. And to subsidize other U.S. tech companies to produce more chips at home. Infrastructure bill was the, you know, typical infrastructure, which has fallen apart in the U.S. That goes to construction companies and parts companies, right? $280 billion goes to semiconductor and tech companies. And then the Inflation Reduction Act was the third act of 2022 that subsidized investors. A part of that was to subsidize alternative investment, you know, wind and solar and so forth. But a big part of that was also to continue to subsidize fossil fuel companies. Joe Manchin made sure of that. The only way that passed was Manchin ensuring that his buddies and him, because he's got investments in fossil fuels, got a big cut of that $369 billion. So $1 trillion and $280 billion, $369 billion, you know, what do you got? You got about $1.7 trillion in investment, business, subsidy, investment in 2022, part of which the prior COVID social spending programs of 2021 got rediverted to the subsidies for businesses. And that's the essence of Biden's fiscal policy. You could sum up Biden's fiscal policy saying, we let the Fed do whatever it wants to raise interest rates to try to control the inflation that's at first running amok, but now chronic. Can't get services down below 5.5% for months now. Okay, let the Fed do that. Yeah, and then let's shift our fiscal policy from this initial American Rescue Plan to these three bills and acts, which takes the money out of the pockets of households and gives it to investors and corporations. That's the fiscal policy of the Biden administration, you see. Monetary policy is the Fed escalating interest rates quickly, with little effect on inflation, some effect. Okay. But the Fed rate hikes destabilize the regional banking industry. And the Fed now has returned towards throwing free money at the system to keep it from a crisis. The Fed, keep in mind, under 2008-09, the Fed threw $4 trillion. The banks were in trouble. Okay, it's called QE, quantitative easing. And some other programs, facilities. And then it threw, you know, under COVID, it threw another $5 trillion. Actually, in the COVID, it was like $4 trillion. And just 6 months before, in 2019, there was a crisis in what was called the repurchase agreement financial market, repo market. The Fed bailed out at about $1 trillion, and then we had the COVID thing, and it threw another $3-4 trillion at it. So the Fed debt is at $9 trillion. And the Fed's trying to, quote, roll off some of that every month, I don't know, $50-60 billion. But it's going to take a long time to get $9 trillion down. to where the Fed was in 2008, which was less than $1 trillion in debt. Now it's $9 trillion in debt. And it's getting deeper in debt because since March, the crisis in the regional banking system, you know, Silicon Valley Bank, First Republic, Signature, those guys, the Fed has opened its money spigot again, right? They created another, quote, facility. That's where they can go and get quick money cheap from the Fed. And also, it's the Fed's traditional discount window where banks can go in trouble and borrow on a short-term basis, you know. So how much has the Fed thrown since March crisis emerged in regional banking? I think it's close to $1 trillion. It's like $95 billion every week now for several weeks. That's at least $400 billion here. And then initially, I think a couple hundred billion in March, early April. So, you know, maybe 700, 800 billion. Certainly by, if it continues at this rate, by the end of this quarter, it'll be another $1 trillion the Fed will have thrown at the banks. This time they were in trouble, you see. In March 2020, they were in trouble. They threw $4 trillion just in case they might have been in trouble. It was the first time we ever bailed out the banks and they didn't need it. Unlike in 2008, they needed it. They got bailed out. They didn't even need it in 2020. The Fed threw money at them. And now, of course, they need it again, and it's throwing money at them. So that's the monetary policy. And the monetary policy is now between a rock and a hard place. It's a major contradiction. And that major contradiction is, as I was predicting for over a year, the Fed could not raise interest rates more than 5.5%, without precipitating a financial instability event, which, of course, happened in March because of the interest rate risk, escalating rates from, I think, like 0.25% to 5%. And that's why I say, the Fed, if it raises rates to 6%, it's going to make it even worse. Because the banking crisis isn't over, as I said. You know, these regional banks are heavily exposed to the commercial real estate market, which is in deep trouble, which by the end of the year, early next year, has to roll over massive junk debt. And a lot of it won't be able to, particularly in the office sector and the malls sector of commercial real estate. You know, hotels and factories sectors are not in that much trouble, but those first two are. And investors and companies in that area are going to have trouble rolling over their debt. And if they can't, they go bankrupt, and the banks that are holding that debt are then in trouble. And the junk bond sector looks like it's in trouble in general. Over the weekend, seven companies filed for bankruptcy because of excessive junk debt that they couldn't get or afford to roll over at the interest rate that exists today for junk. And then there's what's called junk loans or CLOs, collateralized loan obligations. Junk loans, which is a problem too. So those three areas mean that the crisis in the banking, regional banking system is not over, which means the Fed cannot continue to raise rates at the pace it has. Will it raise rates again? It might in June, or it might wait one more month and do it in July. It's going to look at what's happening with the inflation reports in early June, a couple of weeks from now, and what's happening with bank lending, particularly the regional banks. Is that lending being cut off or reducing investment, which has the same effect as if the Fed were raising rates? You see, it's the Fed is looking at the banking lending data here and saying, well, you know, if credit is being contracted here. That's the same as if we raised rates. So maybe the regional banks will do the rate hikes for us, see? So they're waiting on that, and they're waiting on inflation. But the last inflation report was not good. The last inflation report showed that the important services sector of the economy, inflation was very reluctant. They can't get it down. It's been around 5.5%. They can't get it down. They've shaken out what's called headline inflation, energy, because the global economy is slowing fast, by the way. You know, latest report, Germany is in recession. Its factory output's been contracting now for almost a year. And its last GDP growth was like zero. Now it's going to be negative. So Germany's the engine of Europe. Britain's a basket case. And the recovery in China is going much slower than they had thought it would. They thought, oh, China's, you know, coming out of its zero COVID is going to really boom, going to pull up the global economy. It's not. Looks like it's having trouble getting going it in terms of recovery as well. So the global economy is slowing. The global economy, very clearly, is slowing now. Just as the U.S. is just struggling along at near zero, we'll see. Is it going to raise the interest rates? Well, it's got to consider what's going to happen, you know, with unemployment. But their unemployment statistics, you know, is 3.7% unemployment. They don't know what to do with that, you see. They have no idea. Why is it 3.7? Because it really isn't, Jay. 3.7, you know. They look at the U3 unemployment rate. I listened to this conversation this morning here, Friday the 19th, between current Fed Chair Jerome Powell and former Ben Bernanke, chair of the Fed. And I can only come away with the feeling and the sense that these guys are victims of their own economic jargon and nonsense, their own data analysis, you know. They're talking about Phillips curves and Beveridge curves and, the fact that we got 9 million job openings and so forth. They're looking at the data, and I've been saying the data is not as reliable as it used to be, you know. They're stuck in their own macro groupthink, and they don't really understand the changes that have really occurred since COVID in the labor markets, in the product markets, in the financial markets. They don't understand that, I believe. Or, you know, they're just giving cover. They understand it, but they're saying what they got to say. I don't know which one it is. I wouldn't hire these guys as economists for my company, not that I have one. I wouldn't hire these guys. They're thinking in the past. They don't understand that there's not 9 million job openings. There's maybe half of that because most of them are ghost jobs. They're just on paper. There's no intent of hiring. Plus, you know, coming out of COVID, companies just did not hire back. Their whole strategy was, well, we don't know whether this recovery is going to really be sustained, because we saw in 21 it wasn't sustained. So, you know, we're going to go slow. We're not going to hire everybody back. We're going to see if we can run on a smaller labor force, and most of them are running on labor forces of 78% of pre-COVID employed workforce. I mean, railroad, 70% is all they've got. And they like it because that means big profits, 70%. Profit margins are up because they don't have as much labor costs. And, yeah, it drives people crazy who have jobs in railroad, right? But we're not going to give them any time off because, you know, we don't have enough people. We're running out of skeleton crew anyway. You know, you guys can't take off. Well, I don't care if you're sick. You can't take off. That's management and railroads, you see. And that's why we almost had a railroad strike, except the Democrats gave it the deep six. Yeah, you guys strike. we're going to slap you with anti-union, anti-strike legislation. And all the other unions get scared. Oh, you guys can't strike. Look what they're going to do to us all. So they don't. It's illegal to strike in the railroads, effectively. They're never going to let a railroad strike, because a railroad strike would close this country down. You know, the New York Minute, they're not going to allow it. The capitalists aren't going to allow railroad workers to strike. And we're going to see what's going to happen with the Teamsters at the UPS negotiations in a couple months. Yeah, they're going to allow UPS, which isn't as critical transport sector by, as the railroads, of course. But if it looks like the union's about to win something, they'll intervene in that one, too. Too big. What, you got 350,000 workers going to go off, walk out at one time? Okay, so what I'm saying is monetary policy is dead in the water. They can't raise rates without exacerbating the banking crisis. Right? And if they don't raise rates, they're stuck with 5.5% on inflation. To me, that looks like they're between a rock and a hard place, which is exactly what I predicted back in my book in 2017, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. It's pretty clear they're at the end of their ropes, or they're hanging from the cliff by their fingernails, right? And they don't want to let go. If they let go, they're going to fall, but they can't climb back up off the cliff, you know? Maybe that's a better metaphor. And then, you know, the fiscal policy that we started talking about quite a bit here is stuck in the mud as well, because they won't raise taxes. They won't reverse the Trump tax cuts. They got to continue their war spending obscenely, right? And they got $600 billion now in interest they got to pay their capitalist bondholders. So what are they going to do? Well, they're going to have to take it out of the hides of everybody else. Austerity. And that brings us back to where we started. That's what's going on with all the debt ceiling negotiations nonsense behind the scenes. That's what it's all about, you see. Capitalist neoliberal, late 21st neoliberal fiscal monetary policy tools are blunted. They don't work. And the economic house of U.S. capital, late neoliberal era, is in trouble. Huge debt, monetary policy doesn't work, banking instability emerging once again, economy barely growing after $9 trillion stimulus. Don't tell me this is not a crisis that is about to explode. It is. At the same time, they're desperately circling their G7 economic wagons here globally, politically, to try to deal with the decline of the empire abroad. Okay, that's it. I'm out of here.